Payne.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Oliver Davis, here for Joel Payne. Your Honor, may I reserve 3 minutes? This is Joel Payne's appeal from convictions for malicious harassment and first-degree assault. And I'm asking the court to reverse the convictions and dismiss those charges because of the violation of Mr. Payne's due process rights in the loss of potentially exculpatory evidence in this case.
Help me understand the ring argument. Wouldn't it only matter if you could argue that the ring meant he hit him first? I mean, otherwise, they had a witness saying they were pummeling each other. So I'm trying to figure out just how material this evidence would have been had a DNA test been done and shown that it was the victim's DNA.
There is a witness who said that he saw the victim hitting the defendant's body, but the defendant came to this incident for whatever unusual reason with a pre-existing facial injury that was bleeding.
Yeah.
And Mr. Atkins, the victim, said repeatedly, "I never struck Mr. Payne. In fact, I may have tried to swing at him, but I missed." That was his story from the time of the affidavit of probable cause through to trial. "I did not lay hands on him." But we know, it's undisputed, that Mr. Payne's face was bleeding when this incident began. So if tested, if it hadn't been given away by the detective 10 days after the incident, and there was DNA on that ring, that would have showed and, frankly, given lie to Mr. Atkins' repeated assertions that he did not strike Mr. Payne. And we believe that would have certainly done what Mr. Payne, frankly, all he needed to do was raise reasonable doubt in this case where the state was required to disprove.
Were there other witnesses that had a different story than the victim had about whether or not he threw any punches?
I missed the first part of your question. I'm sorry.
Wasn't there some other evidence that the victim had thrown some punches?
There was one witness who said that he saw body blows being exchanged. Now, certainly it was helpful to Mr. Payne that there was a witness who could say that blows were being exchanged. But this would have been physical evidence that would have eviscerated the victim's claims that he never struck the defendant, and that would have been vital in a self-defense case. This certainly was potentially exculpatory evidence by any definition. We've cited a number of cases. The one that comes to mind to me most frequently is the Illinois v. Fisher case, in which the police lost a bag of cocaine before the defense could test it. Now, the cocaine had already been tested by the police lab and been determined apparently to be cocaine, but the evidence was still potentially exculpatory because defense testing could have shown that it was not cocaine, which would have eviscerated the state's case. The rule is that potentially exculpatory evidence requires, or the loss of potentially exculpatory evidence requires, reversal if it has been lost in bad faith by the police. Bad faith is a question, according to Youngblood, of the police knowledge of the exculpatory value of the evidence at the time it was lost. And here's what we know Detective DeVries knew at the time, because this was the state's offer of proof at the pretrial hearing. He knew, first of all, that this was a self-defense case. In fact, he went to the hospital and examined the complainant's hands for injuries in order to assess the question of self-defense. He knew that Mr. Payne came to the incident with blood on his face. You know, I think a ring could pick up DNA if somebody is punched, but it certainly could. It would be highly likely that Mr. Payne's DNA is on that ring if he comes to the incident with a bleeding face. The state's other rationales, their arguments as to why it wasn't bad faith to give this ring away, was essentially the detective believed that Mr. Payne was guilty because he believed Mr. Atkins, the victim. But that's not a determination for the detective to make.
It may not be an appropriate determination, but is the determination an act of bad faith?
It is in bad faith.
Do you have a case that provides that?
I think that the definition of bad faith turns on knowledge.
Okay, you're and not a reasonable, telling me about a case, which makes me think you don't have a case that says that.
I do. Youngblood has always said, and Wittenbarger adopting that rule, has always said that the question of bad faith is to be determined by all the circumstances of the case. Now, Hannah is a case.
Have one that's closer than some general rule where an officer made a decision, and it may have been an inappropriate decision, but there's no evidence of evil intent.
So United States v. Elliott, I think, is a case that would stand for the proposition that when, in all of the circumstances of the case, a police officer allows evidence to be lost that is highly likely to be probative for the defense, that is bad faith. That's the case in which the officers allowed glassware to be destroyed, even though the officer knew and should have known that glassware is likely to contain residue that would show the crime or show that the residue was not methamphetamine.
Should have known equals bad faith?
No, I'm not saying should have known, but Elliot...
I'm a little troubled by the idea that someone can't make an honest mistake or do something stupid.
But it can't be as stupid as what happened in this case. You know, we're not assessing the well-meaning but mistaken act of my great aunt Matilda as an amateur sleuth. We're talking about a qualified police detective who knows that self-defense is the issue. He knows you can't see DNA on a ring, even though that claim was offered. He knows that Mr. Payne is saying, he hit me first. He knows there's blood on Mr. Payne's face. No reasonable police officer in any circumstance would believe that it was appropriate to go into the evidence room 10 days after the crime and give physical evidence, that ring, back to the accusing witness in the case.
What you just articulated sounds like the abuse of discretion standard for a trial judge. We don't call a trial judge as acting in bad faith when he or she abuses that person's discretion. It's the bad faith. Bad has something more than stupid associated with it.
So Elliot stands, and in fact Hannah, that the state has cited, stands for the notion that when police do something with evidence that violates every common sense notion of how the police should handle evidence, that is bad faith. So I would cite Elliot, which we've discussed in our brief, and indeed I would rely on the State v. Hanna case that the state has cited, which imparts the notion of reasonableness. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. Dennis McCurdy for the State of Washington in this case. And yes, I'm a different attorney than is listed on your calendar. I am filling in at the last moment for Mr. Porter due to an illness. I will also admit to start out with, my knowledge of the case is not as complete as I'm sure Mr. Porter's was, but sometimes fresh eyes actually are useful. And before I talk about due process, I will say that those eyes, when I'm looking at this case, there's three issues that this court does not need to decide that have been briefed. And that's whether the assault one and malicious mischief are the same criminal conduct, ineffective assistance of counsel for failing to raise that issue, and ineffective assistance of counsel and conflict of interest in regards to sentencing issues. The reason for that is the state has conceded federal bank robbery is not comparable to robbery in the state of Washington. Therefore, the offender score is incorrect. The defendant must go back to be resentenced. The malicious mischief has an anti-merger clause attached to it for the same criminal conduct issue, but that is permissive. So even if this court found that those two crimes are the same criminal conduct, the trial court can still impose separate sentences and count them against each other. So on remand, the defendant can raise all of these issues again, and ineffective assistance of counsel is simply irrelevant for this court to decide.
Let me ask you on that. After defense counsel filed his, we'll call it for lack of anything else, an Anders motion.
Yes.
It raised two issues of conflict that I see. One is on the sentencing, whether there was a conflict with counsel over the sentencing. I agree. We wouldn't need to address that.
Right.
But the other issue it raises is for the motion for the new trial. We're in that position. So that we still need to address.
I do think this court needs to address that aspect. And do you want me to deal with that instead of the due process? I will answer the court's question. Okay. Essentially, the way I look at it is there's a question of what did happen, what should have happened, and what was required to happen. Now, the defendant went to trial with conflict-free counsel. After trial, he files a bar complaint, and he wants a new attorney to file a motion for a new trial. Now, actually, I don't think the court should have substituted counsel, because the defendant made no colorable claim that there was some sort of basis.
I don't care about that. The court did substitute counsel.
That's correct. So the court did that. And the new attorney had two things to investigate. Investigate whether to file a new trial motion and for sentencing. And we don't need to deal with sentencing. What defense counsel does, I believe his name is Pelkey, he talks to the defendant, he talks to the defense attorney. All of this is in his, quote, Anders brief. He reviews all the evidence that he can review, reviews all the discovery, and says, I can't find a legitimate issue. So I'm not going to follow one. Now, was it appropriate to file in the way of an Anders brief? No, it's not really applicable. But in his affidavit, he lays out everything he did and the fact that he cannot bring a new trial motion because it's frivolous. Now, at that point, what should have happened?
Doesn't he undermine his client by filing that affidavit? Shouldn't he just simply advise the court that his ethical duties will not allow him to file a motion and say no more?
That's exactly correct. He should have said, Your Honor, I've reviewed the record. I cannot find a good faith basis to bring a motion. Let's proceed to sentencing. That's what should have occurred. Now, but the question is, and what happened next and what had to have happened? He could not file that motion. It's frivolous. He looked through he lists all the things that the defense wanted to raise. For example, the defendant wanted to raise the fact that the victim who testified at trial was an imposter. Well, of course he's not going to bring that motion. The defendant said that the police altered the videotapes, said the prosecutor lied to the jury. All of these just, quite frankly, ridiculous issues. And defense counsel indicates all that. Defense counsel then says the only way you can raise these motions, and I think it's important, this is in his Anders brief, I'll call it an affidavit, he says the only way you can raise these motions, and it's important you'd be able to air your grievances if you go pro se, because I can't do it. And the court, I think incorrectly, allowed that to occur. Now, the question is, though,
if you think that was incorrect, what should the court have done then?
The court should have said, counsel, first of all, said, you know, why are you filing this in the way of an Anders brief? It doesn't fit this scenario. If you're saying what your affidavit says, you don't have any good faith basis to raise an issue, then shouldn't we be proceeding straight to sentencing?
Substitute counsel go further and say, and as a result of this, I really can't represent him at sentencing?
No, that's not
what. So the court could have said, I'm going to deny your Anders motion. I'm going to not hear the new trial motion because it's not brought by counsel. Let's go to sentencing. The trial court could have done that.
Yes, that's what the trial court should have done. Defendants don't raise motions. They don't raise a 3-6. They don't raise a 3-5 or 404.
Defendants are anymore. It's sort of become unfortunately fashionable for defendants, even with represented counsel, to file their own motions, which then judges routinely say, "I'm not going to hear it because you're represented by counsel."
Right.
Could the trial court have decided to proceed to hear the sentencing before addressing both Anders' brief at trial court and new trial motion, and after sentencing allowed counsel to withdraw and allowed him to proceed pro se?
So go to sentencing
first. You've got this sticky wicket issue, and then you've got a pretty straightforward issue. We're going to deal with a straightforward issue with counsel, and then we'll deal with the sticky wicket.
The straightforward issue meaning sentencing?
Sentencing. Much more straightforward than this other issue.
Well, certainly. Defense claims, there was this conflict of interest. I don't think there was a conflict of interest. Saying that there's no, that it's a frivolous motion doesn't create a conflict of interest. I think the court would have at least still had to have acquired, because obviously this was an odd situation in terms of the defense attorney filing the Anders brief. I think the court still should have asked defense counsel, can you represent him at sentencing, which he actually said, the defense attorney said, I can do that. I don't think the defendant wants me to, but then the defendant actually said, yeah, I want him to represent me at sentencing. So then they could have done that. Now, post-sentencing, you know, you'd have to apply by all the, you know, timeliness rules, that sort of stuff. So maybe he could have. Now, if he files an appeal, however, the trial court can't act without the permission of this court because it would affect the appeal. So there are certain limitations, but
if we were to say that there was a denial of right to counsel here for whatever reason, and we remanded it back, how would we avoid not having the same situation recur? In other words, he goes back, he gets a new lawyer, he tells the new lawyer, I want to argue the new trial motion. The new lawyer said there's no merit to this, and then he's going to say, I want to fire that lawyer.
Right.
So how would we avoid that if we reach that conclusion?
Well, first of all, one of the things is the defense keeps saying he should get his conviction reversed. He cites no case, and there is no case I've found, that a post-conviction denial of his right to counsel results in a reversal. But I think if it did get remanded for this motion, I think the defendant would be limited to the issues that he claims he wants raised, and a new attorney, I guess, would look at it. But then if he tries to fire his attorney, he doesn't have a constitutional right to raise that issue. You can't simply fire your attorney, have a 3-6 motion, bring an attorney back, you know.
But once you fire your attorney, don't you lose your constitutional right to the attorney anyway if you decide to go pro se? Once you've decided you want to go pro se, you don't get to go back and say, now I want an attorney again?
Well, I think that's up to the discretion of the trial court.
But the trial court has discretion to say no new attorney if
yes,
you've gone pro se.
That is correct. And that happens all the time, at least especially when you've got situations when people do that over and over and over again. I do want to say really quick, because I've only got 59 seconds left, a couple things about the due process issue. First of all, the defendant keeps saying we conceded certain things. All through their brief and up here today. And I looked at the citations in the record where he cites you. The state didn't concede all of these things. The due process violation is determined at the time the evidence is lost. In this case, the time Detective DeVries turned it over to the victim. It is based on what he knew at that time. There was no offer of proof by the state, as defense counsel got up here and said. The defense attorney did not present any evidence whatsoever. They didn't call any witnesses. They didn't provide any sort of manual of what the evidence policies are. That did not occur. And I would ask this court rhetorically, under the defendant's theory, every TMV, every theft case, DNA or the absence is always important. That means you cannot give the property of a victim back to the victim? I mean, what if the defendant FTAs? That's my time, unless there's any questions. Thank you.
You can't give the property of the victim back to the victim when the property is a ring that was on the victim's hands when the defendant says he was punching my bloody face.
Argument about the state of the record before the trial court at the time it considered the motion.
So the state did make an offer of proof on the question of what the officer knew and what the officer was thinking at the time he released the evidence. I believe the record of the pretrial hearing absolutely shows that. The state's rationale was, well, the detective believed that the victim was telling the truth and the defendant was lying. The detective believed that the defendant was the first aggressor, and you can't succeed with self-defense if you're the first aggressor. You know, notably, the state's claim that the defendant was the first aggressor was another criminal allegation of harassment. The state also claimed that, I'm losing my train of thought here, but this was an offer of proof as to the reason why the police officer gave the ring back to the victim. So that is, the state's stuck with that because we are judging the officer's actions. They could have called the police officer to say give some different reason, but they gave an offer of proof.
I wanted to ask you the same question I put to the respondent, which is, let's assume we remanded back for a limited purpose, resentencing, perhaps to argue the new trial motion, appointment of new counsel.
How does this whole scenario not just repeat itself?
Defense counsel, instead of abandoning his client at a critical stage of the proceeding, files that sort of brief, which counsel file in these cases all the time, you know, setting out the claimed issues, making the best argument to the court, and then allowing the court to decide. And that is functionally and constitutionally different than being appointed for a purpose and then standing up and saying, this is completely frivolous. I have found no trial issue after reviewing this entire case. That is functionally different. So that's what would happen. That's what defense counsel should have done. Now, Your Honor asked, what should the court do? The court should have granted defense counsel's motion. It's incorrect for the respondent to state that defense counsel believed he could go forward. Defense counsel's representation was, I don't believe ethically, and I've talked to my superiors and they don't believe, that upon filing this motion, I can go forward representing him for any purpose at all. And that was correct.
Just put the judge in a position of having to appoint a new counsel?
At that point, once the Anders brief was filed, that was a line that was crossed. That new counsel should file a motion that makes the arguments the defendant wants to make and then to move on to sentencing.
But if he can't find anything in the record to support it, he thinks it truly would be frivolous, then what's he do?
Well, he can perhaps decline to raise certain issues, but he's been appointed to file a motion for new trial.
That's what if he can find no basis ethically to support a motion?
There's nothing that precludes defense counsel from making an argument on the motion for new trial on the issues for which the state, the court, granted a motion for new trial. And a pro forma motion, even though pro forma, is fundamentally different to the constitutional right to counsel than abandoning counsel at a critical stage. So we ask that the court reverse for that reason additionally, although, of course, we're asking the court to reverse the convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Next case this morning is Air Plus Beauty Outlet versus OMH.